Session number 26584.
Roger Johnson, Reel 6. And so that was the end of that?
Yes, we weren't charged. And we shouldn't have done it. It was theft and we shouldn't have done it. But we did. We were young commandos and we did it. It's over. And thank goodness nobody got hurt. And that chief police did the right thing. He said, cough up and I'll let you off, which is good.
What happened to you after that? How did you spend the rest of your career?
Well, I might have then decided that climbing was decidedly dangerous and that I could handle it, even though I was very scared. It was very exciting and I climbed in different parts of the world and I was very proud of myself being a climber. And then I thought, well, there's something else that I can do, and that's become a parachutist. So for a year and a half, I had my name on the list to do a paracourse in Abingdon, Royal Air Force Abingdon near Oxford. And I went off there and I think I did a month's training, and you get attached to, you join this squad, and in this squad could be guys that are training to be going to the parachute regiment. So you're a mix. So there was two Marines, two Royal Marines from Lymston, joining a recruit squad at Abingdon. And there I did 10 days training before I got into the air. So the training would involve working in a hangar, jumping off benches, doing side left, doing rolls, side left, back, side left, side right, back front, learning how to roll, and then jumping off a platform and in a harness with a cable attached to a drum, and around the drum would be a fan, and so you just jump off, you know, bloody high, and the fan blades going through the air would arrest your fall, and you'd land on a coconut mat. So it was all about jumping, landing, sliding, learning how to fall safely, you know, i.e. as in heel, both heels hitting the ground, then the side of the leg, and then your backside, and then your back and your shoulders, and rolling rather than trying to land and stand up and get damaged, rolling out of the fall. Because when you land on a parachute, it's quite fierce. I've been knocked out twice before lunch. So that was training. And then you go up into a balloon, and that's extremely frightening. And anybody that says it's not frightening is a liar, or is mad and shouldn't be up there anyway. So there were two Marines and one young lad who wanted to go into the parachute regiment, and the instructor. So we got up 800 feet in a balloon, and you're still tethered by a cable onto a drum of a lorry, 3-ton lorry, up to 800 feet. And it's bloody, terribly, terribly, and it's silent. That's also frightening. Then this young lad who was training to go into the army, the parachute regiment, started screaming to God. Suddenly he'd become a believer. He was screaming to God, if you help me, I'll always go to church. I've always believed in you anyway. You know, God help me, I'm a coward. If you help me, I'll always go to church, you know. Didn't really want this on my first jump. So he's screaming and crying and making one hell of a noise. And he's only about 3 feet from me. So the instructor ignored him and said to the other Royal Marine, his name's Wilson. Righto, Wilson, stand in the door. Do this, do that. Right, ready, go. So Tug Wilson jumped. And all the time, this boy's screaming next to me. Then Tug Wilson's jump, he was okay. So then it was Johnson, right, stand in the door, you know, red on, there's no balloon, no lights there, but it would be sort of red on, do this, green on, go. And I went, and all the time this boy was screaming. And in actual fact, the boy did jump. He said, you'll never make me jump, I'm a coward, you know, God help me, if you help me, I'll always go to church. All the way. And he screamed and cried all the way down. He did jump, and he screamed, and he was lying on the ground, and he was still saying, you'll never make me jump, I'm a coward. He was actually on the ground. So that's how frightened people can get. That was my first balloon jump out of the door. And the second one was an equally terrifying event. You do it through the hole in the balloon cage. So they lift up the trap door and you stand around the hole. And I went up, my instructor was a guy, all the instructors, the dispatchers are Royal Air Force, and they are very, very good guys. They're very experienced, they're very brave, and they're very knowledgeable. They are smashing jumping instructors. They are the right guys for the job. They come from the Royal Air Force physical training instructors to become parachute jumping instructors and to become free fall, Royal Air Force free fall team. So they are knowledgeable men, great guys. So I'm in this balloon cage there. Mitchell, the instructor, is in one side. I'm in another corner, and two other men in the other corners. Is there two corners? Yeah, four corners. Yeah. So we're now looking through a hole 800 feet. And this parachute jumping instructor, a chap called Mitchell, he's wearing a parachute. He said, I don't think what you've been told is you stand on the edge of the hole, and then on the command go, you put your hands over your reserve and go. And he jumped out the balloon and put his hands out to stop himself, and he came back in. And he said, righto, Johnson, you, first one. Well, I couldn't stand up. I was nearly crapping myself. You know, I thought, I'm bloody frightened out of my wits. And there's this parachute jumping instructor jumping through the hole, because they're a bit wacky, because they're freefall merchants. You know, they go out at 20,000 feet and do funnies. So he's jumped out the hole and put his arms out and pulled himself back in again. And he is wearing a chute. And I was crapping. I couldn't keep my knees together. So I went out, and that was okay. And then you go from balloon jumping to aircraft jumping, culminating in with a heavy container. You go out both sides at night, port and starboard. You go out with sort of 100 pounds strapped to your tits here, and you're out into the dark. And there's a lot of you, both doors at the same time, bang, 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 bang. And it's an incredible experience, but it's very frightening because they take the door off. You sit there in the dark, and you sit in a net, a crash net, and they take the door off. And you know that you're not coming back on that plane to land. The door is off. You're going out that door. And it's dark. And you're carrying, a 100-pound container. That's ammunition and weapons and food and provisions, that sort of thing. Years ago, I think that men used to jump separated from their containers. So the men would jump, and then the containers would be thrown out. So the container may come down hanging in the tree 3 miles away. So the man's running around trying to get his weapon, that sort of thing. So now you jump with a container. And what happens is, when you come out of the slipstream, you jump. When you come out of the slip, when your chute develops, then you make sure it's all clear. Then you have a leg pin and a heart and the buckles here. And then you release your container, and it shoots away. And then it stops on a piece of rope 20 feet below you. And then it starts swinging through people's parachute rigging lines, So when that lands, and then you land, so then you've got your container, you've got your gear, so you can, move on. Because parachuting is only a means of getting from A to B. It's nothing special, but it is. But it's a matter of transport, getting on the ground and then doing your job. That's what you've got to do. You're not just there to sort of look good. That's just to get there to start, and then you start yomping, and then you go off and fight the battle. So it's very special. I think it's very special being a parachutist. I'm very proud of having done that. In fact, that men don't sleep the night before a jump, and you'll find them in the barrack room. They're smoking at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they eat. They'll all tell you that, well, it's a piece of piss. I'm not bloody scared. Then why are you and me awake at 3 in the morning? You're bloody frightened. But people won't admit it, because they daren't, because you've got to be tough. And then when it's done, they're standing at the bar saying, well, it's a piece of piss, Yeah, I remember seeing your face, up in the aeroplane, and your face was white. You took your helmet off, vomited in your helmet, and put your helmet back on again. So it's really, is it only a piece of piss? Is it that easy, And afterwards, you're standing at the bar, and then you get presented with a pair of wings, and you spend the rest of your life walking around sideways, because then you've got it. And then you're the member of an elite band. So then whenever you're in uniform, anybody who's paratrained has got these wings. It's two wings and a parachute in the middle. And anybody that's got that, then he's not just infantry. He's not just a foot soldier. He's special. He's a special guy. So then you can warm towards him, because then you've both been a cut above the norm. So you're a member of a special group, a special club. You're para. And it's a fearsome thing to do. But then you can spend the rest of your life bragging about it, which is what I do. Yeah, I'm proud. Yeah. Bloody hell. Yeah.
Did you ever get to use those skills, actually, in real combat?
No. I was trained in the 60s. And that was it. I did a month's training. And I've been bragging about it ever since. And if ever I was photographed, I'd make sure that my right shoulder was in the frame. Hey, he's para commander, And it's and all the cuttings I have, about six cuttings there from different national newspapers regarding the trip that I've just done up country, you know, the Land's End, the John O'Groats, on my own in a fortnight. So I make sure that the reporters know, you know, to put down that I'm para. Because I wasn't just a commando, I was a para commando. And why not? You know, I'm proud of what I've done. And why not? It's, you know, this is England. There's so many people out there kicking and scratching, if you had a Rolls Royce, scratching your Rolls Royce. It's very English to pull down. It's fashionable to say, well, what do you want to do that for? And I said, because I'm proud. And I am proud. I think I've got something to be proud of. You know, I started off getting my ass kicked as a kid, you know, from a children's home, and I'm on my own. You know, and I could end up on a bench, you know, being a pisshead. But I haven't chosen to go down that line. 3 years ago, my world collapsed, and I went to the doctor, and he said, I said, can you make the pain go away? And he said, no. He said, I can't make the pain go away. He said, I can put you on some tablets. He says, but they're highly addictive. So if you need any more, I said, I'll take you off them and put you onto something else. So I was living in a cellar with a broken heart, and I went and sought counselling at Chichester Counselling Services. You know, and over the 3 years, they've helped. They've got me to talk, which I've never been allowed to do. You see. It's not been permitted for guys to talk. Now it is. It's becoming acceptable. And thank goodness for that. You know, firemen and police and men from the Special Air Service and soldiers and, you know, people. I mean, I've been a nurse and I've seen men suffer terribly, you know, at the hands of the Japanese and the Germans in prisoner of war camps. And many, many years after, I'm looking after them as a nurse and they're still screaming at night because they've never been allowed to talk. And they've made a mess of their wife and family because, you know, their dad, the girl's dad, has become a mess because the Japanese mucked him up in the 40s, you see, and he's never been emptied out. So he doesn't make a good father or a good husband, you know, because nobody said, hey, do you want to talk about it? Now, that's why I've been on this long distance trip, to get people to talk. So it's okay for men to talk and not be ridiculed. I don't mind being ridiculed now. In 40 years ago, I'd have been scared to be ridiculed. You know, well, you're queer or something. You're a brown atter, Jono. You know, you're a pufter. No, I'm not a pufter. You know, I'm still a bloody tough guy. And I'm prepared to step out and say, I think half of Chichester knows, you know, that I have counselling. I'm supposed to have counselling this afternoon. So. It might, you know, guys might think, well, if he can have counselling, then maybe, you know, maybe I should as well. You know, I'm only trying to help because there's 72,000 men in jail, and they're not all criminals. A lot of guys will have been in jail, and I was one step away from going to jail myself. They'll be in jail because they've had to keep up a tough veneer. They didn't want to, but that's what they've had to do. They've had to be tough, and inside they're not tough. They're busted up inside. I've now become a singer. I've become a solo competition singer, and now I have to be careful in the songs that I sing because I could start crying. And for me to admit that I start crying, but it's there. Yeah. So, you know, us guys it's got to be acceptable for us to say, you know, I don't feel well mentally. One in four of us is a nutcase. I'm a nutcase. But it's a good life. Yeah.
You did 12 years. In the Royal Marines, all in all.
Yes.
How did you spend the remainder of your career after you had trained as a para commando?
As a climber, I worked in 40 commando, 41 commando, 45 commando, 44 one 45, and two ships, HMS Bulwark and HMS Lion. And on the Lion, that's the flagship of the Home Fleet, I did some work on there for a year or so, doing the independence of the Gambia in West Africa, and then the independence of Malta, Don Mintoff, the president of Malta. So I volunteered and did as many things as I could, and I had a fairly exciting life. And that attitude is still with me now. I'm still, at my age, doing working for charities and having a fairly exciting life.
Any incidents that you want to talk about which relates to those two periods?
What, in the forces?
Yes.
Well, no. The 12 years went by You do 9 years over the age of 18. Well, I went in at 15, so there's 3 years that doesn't even count. And they mockingly call that girls' time, and it's boys' time, it's girls' time. You know, from the age of 15 to 18 doesn't even count. So man's time is counted from the age of 18 onwards. So I did my time, and I was discharged from Limpston Infantry Training Centre, Royal Marines, and I got marched in front of the colonel. And I thought he'd say, you know, well, Johnson, you know, you thought about signing on, because if you leave, the Royal Marines will just disintegrate. We can't manage without you. Instead of that, the colonel stood up, shook my hand and said, well, thank you for what you've done. If I show you the door, Sergeant Major. So I walked out and got the bus to where I was living. It's tongue in cheek, you know, but so nobody asked me to sign on. They just said, you know, well done. Off you go. That's 12 years. So you come in as a boy at 15 and you go out at 27 waiting at the bus stop.
Did the Royal Marines help you in any way to find a job?
I was allowed to go on a month's course. I can't think of the name. I did a month's course down at Nelson, HMS Nelson in Portsmouth. Not sort of rehabilitation centre, not a rehabilitation, but something. And I wanted to do, don't forget, I'd never worked. I'd come from school. So I had never, by the time I was 27, I didn't know how to put a light bulb in. Didn't know how to mend a plug. Because I'd come from school. So I thought, well, what do you do? There was no career people. Nobody said, sit down, what would you like to do? You were on your own walking around thinking, well, what do I do? So I'll be a car mechanic. Then, well, that course is full up. But you can do a bricklayer. You can be a brickie. I thought, what was a bricklayer do? Well, I don't know. I've never worked, you see. I didn't know anything. So I went and did a bricklaying course, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's highly constructive, and I was taught by a Cornish man, and I built, and I was laid, and I laid bricks, and I built chimneys, and built doors and windows, and I thought, this is bloody great. This is very creative, and it's quite tough as well, being a brickie. So then I did a course at a place called Plimpton. This was after I got out of the forces, and so that was a government training centre. Plimpton near Plymouth, and I did a 6 month and a very good course there as well, very strict government training course, and I learned bricklaying and building for 6 months, and by goodness me, there was no messing about there. Every day you had a 20 minute lecture and you took notes, then you went home and then you wrote up your notes and you drew diagrams, and then your book went in for marking on Monday morning. A very good course, very strict. In fact, I got hauled up before the chiefs, you know, for running one time in the establishment. You don't run. Good course. And I went out, I became a brickie. And I think I became a good bricklayer because I cared. I had to keep my, as a bricklayer, I had to keep my service life a secret, because if bricklayers, and bricklayers, if they'd have found out that I was ex-military and only done a 6 month course, they wouldn't have worked with me. Because they've done 7 year apprenticeship, you know, and you spend the sort of first 15 years, you know, getting your ass kicked and being abused, you know, do this, do that, bang, kicking work over, you know, get work kicked over by the foreman, that's what they do it again. So I had to keep myself, I had to keep it quiet. And I think they rather got the impression, this is in the 70s in Luton, that I was might have been ex-prisoner, ex-jail. So that was okay. You see, it's okay if he's just got out of jail, then, you know, well, he's one of us, and you know, he's a good geezer. So I'd rather let that go along. That's why I was a little slow on learning, because they've been laying bricks for 15 years. I haven't been laying in 6 months, but I daren't tell them that I left forces. So I had to work very quickly and learn building much quicker than anybody else, because I had a family to look after, you see. And so one time I held a job for 40 minutes. 40 minutes and I was fired. Literally kicked and thrown, punched off the site. That's how it was. I was back home before my daughter went to play school. So it was rough.
So you settled into a career.
Mm.
Any other problems that you had in adjusting to?
Well, I didn't have any problems in adjusting because I was disciplined. So whatever came along, you just did. And that's why now I'm disciplined. If I say I'm going to go take a bicycle somewhere or a motor or whatever thing, whatever project I'm doing, I've recently become a horse rider and I'm now training to be a glider pilot. You just do it. You know, you don't go off in a group and hold each other's hand. You just get a night and go and do it. So I don't have any problems in adjusting. You know, whatever comes along, you do. And now I'm learning to be a singer. There's no adjusting about it. You know, you now have a singing teacher. So, you know, I haven't had any opportunity to sit around and talk about what I would like to do. Things crop up and you say, right, let's go and do them. Let's do it. Sounds exciting. Do it. Rather than, you know, than wait too long and end up on a deathbed thinking, oh, I wish I'd done this. You know, when I get to my deathbed, I'm going to think, well, I've done a hell of a lot. Nothing academic. I've learned a guitar and I've learned a foreign language and I've done 3 years diver studying, you know. But, you know, I didn't have the opportunity to have any education. At 15, I didn't even know my alphabet. So my life has been my life. I've had to do something. And I have ample opportunity. If I want to go and study, then the college is up there. If I'm not studying, then it's my fault. Nobody else's, because I'm a lazy brain. You know, the opportunities are there, aren't they, to study.
Did you miss the Royal Marines when you left?
No. No, I'm very proud of being a Royal Marine Commando, but I've never wanted to go back because I'm moving forward. I got married and had children, and it was my object to learn to be a builder bloody quickly, because I'm working with professional men, and they're not social workers. If you can't keep up, they'll chuck you out. I didn't miss the Royal Marines, but I'm proud to have been there. I'm not always proud to have been a bricklayer, but I'm proud to have been a bootneck. Yeah. I know a couple of other bootnecks now who are not like me at all. They've got older. And I'm not getting old. I'm still doing things. I'm still doing triathlons and keeping myself fit and strong. So I don't look back. There's so many things to do looking forward. And to get to my object is to keep out of two institutions, to keep out of jail and to keep out of the hospital. You know, and I'm managing to keep myself fit and strong, and I haven't got a criminal record. And in this country, you've only got a cough to, you know, don't forget to pay your road fund tax on your car licence. You know, it's too easy to go to jail in this country. So I keep myself legal, yeah, and clean, because I don't want to go to jail. It's a waste of time going to jail. So I keep out of the penitentiary, and because I've been a nurse, I've seen the inside of a hospital, so I try and keep myself fit and strong. I don't smoke, I don't drink to excess, I don't take drugs. I can do 70 odd press ups at my age, so I'm doing what I can do to keep myself fit and strong. I've got to look after my body. I don't eat very much because, you know, if I get ill, then I can't have any fun. If I keep fit and strong, then I can be having fun, having girlfriends and doing crazy things, you know, on a bicycle or a glider until I'm 92 if I want to. But I'd like to help other people. And I can't help them if I'm not strong. I've got to be strong to help the weak.
Do you think that discipline comes from your time as a Royal Marine?
I think it may. I don't know whether it comes, because I know other Royal Marines who are nothing like me. There's nothing wrong with them. But I think my discipline has come from my childhood, wanting to be noticed, having a very bright brother, Martin, and me being illiterate. And so instead of staying illiterate, then I've staying in an illiterate state. I've tried to do things which don't require too much brain power. And of course, I went into things that were muscular, where I could get through on muscle power and daring. So that maybe I want to be noticed. Maybe I'm a show off. I want to be noticed, and I can't be noticed in the classroom. And I'm no good. I don't play sport. I've never played sport. I couldn't kick a football. I don't do tennis, golf. I don't do any games at all. I do sports, and the sort of thing I do on my own. And if you get it wrong, at that there, if you get it wrong, you don't come back. You don't. My life is so severe. There's not a lot of play in my life. But I choose to do things which are very dangerous. And having done them, then I feel, you know, 10 feet high. And people come up to me in the town and say, well done for what you've done. So I don't play. I don't play games. I court quite dangerous situations. That's what gives me my excitement. Yeah. And it makes me proud as well.
Thank you.
Okay.